not a sprain or an itch. Pain that swell in a twitch. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of the Hey Doc Show. Harold Lasky is both the medical director and a physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida, and will be your host for the next half hour. With him is his lovely wife Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT and X-ray tech. Together, they hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
Remember when in late 2020, the COVID-19 vaccines were just being tested, and a problem had occurred with some vaccines? Everyone is afraid that if you did not get the full dose at each vaccination, that you could be less protected.
Now, a new study that comes after a COVID-19 vaccine trial error has led to an unexpected discovery.
Over 1,000 participants were accidentally given half doses for their first dose. But by the end of the trial, it was actually found that they were potentially more protected than those receiving two standard doses. Now, this was a very controversial dosing mistake, which marred those early announcements revealing the efficacy of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine.
But it appears that this very error, strangely, led to better results. Now, researchers from Northwestern Medicine have repeated those accidental findings and shown that some vaccines may be more effective if the first dose is much lower than the second.
It was late in 2020, following several promising announcements of successful Phase 3 clinical trials testing mRNA COVID-19 vaccines, and pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca revealed exciting results for its vaccine candidate. The initial press announcement indicated the vaccine was 70% effective at preventing COVID-19.
Now, it has been seen that giving a half dose initially and later a full dose led to even higher success, around 90% compared to the standard dose protocol.
This was not initially the plan for the companies, but this mistake certainly helped elucidate a better protocol. The company didn't initially disclose the fact this half-dose cohort was a mistake. However, the error was quickly incorporated into the trial as an alternative dosing experiment.
So, in fact, the company was lucky to have made the mistake and lucky to have included those who took the one-half dose into their study.
Normally, in the first phase of any human vaccine trial, which are called dose escalation studies, a two-dose vaccine protocol, these dose escalation studies begin by offering a few people a low first dose, and that's called the prime dose. A second booster shot with that same low dose is given. Then and only then, if that has been found safe, will other participants be administered a slightly higher dose, again with the same two-dose protocol.
The idea is to make sure the vaccine is safe. So scientists use dose escalation to determine what is often referred to as the Goldilocks zone.
They wanted to find out just what is the minimum dose of a vaccine that you can give to someone while still getting a good immune response. In their study, that is the AstraZeneca trial protocol, the participants received the irregular first and second doses, and they also experienced a longer gap between the two doses than the other participants.
So was the vaccine more efficacious due to the dose difference, or was it because of the longer gap between doses?
To investigate this question, the researchers looked at immune responses in mice to two different COVID-19 vaccines, CanSino and Sputnik V. Now, both of these are adenovirus serotype 5 vaccine using the same viral vector as AstraZeneca's candidate.
The study reported that a low-dose prime followed by a higher-dose boost elicited significantly better immune responses in the mice, both qualitatively and quantitatively, compared to two high doses.
The researchers also saw similar low-dose, high-dose benefits with an experimental HIV vaccine that uses the same adenovirus vector as the COVID-19 vaccines. So due to this initial error, we know that the low-dose, high-dose protocol may be beneficial with other vaccines. One problem, of course, is that the low first dose does leave one less protected during the period between the first and second dose as compared to the protection given by the standard two-dose regimen.
But there was even more than was learned. The researchers also confirmed better immune responses can be generated by extending the gap between first and second doses.
But because we were and still are in the pandemic, there's a problem raised by these results in that a lower prime dose with a longer gap may leave people susceptible to infection. And again, this is not ideal in a pandemic when time is of the essence.
As of 2 days ago, there have been an estimated 30 million to 50 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine made early this year that sits idle in Emergent BioSolutions plant in Baltimore awaiting a green light from U.S. regulators to ship.
Emergent, a contract drug manufacturer, is still waiting for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, to approve release of those doses. The agency must still inspect and authorize the plant before Emergent can ship newly manufactured drug substance.
The FDA in April halted operations at Emergent's production facility after J&J's vaccine was found to be contaminated with material from AstraZeneca's COVID-19 shots, which were also being manufactured there at the same time.
This contamination ruined about 15 million Johnson & Johnson doses, and it really set back the U.S. vaccine rollout by weeks. That's pretty interesting to know. Of the 100 million doses worth of vaccine material, Emergent described it in an April congressional hearing as being sidelined. The FDA has so far cleared 9 batches of J&J's vaccine and 3 batches of AstraZeneca's. It's not disclosed how many doses were in those batches.
Emergent has begun making new vaccine substance, but the FDA has yet to provide guidance on when it plans to inspect the Baltimore facility.
The FDA said in a statement that it conducted a limited inspection of Emergent's facility in July to confirm that it had conducted corrective actions following that April production pause. However, according to the FDA's previous inspection, they had turned up several sanitary safety and bad manufacturing practice issues at the plant itself.
Following the Emergent plant shutdown, J&J lowered its production target for 2021 to between 500 million and 600 million doses from around 1 billion. It expects to be able to make 1 billion doses annually starting next year.
So apparently they do not expect this pandemic to be resolved this or next year, if ever. And we may be in store for yearly boosters, just like we get for the flu. Now let's get to some other piece of news. Last month, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition published reports that seemed to stir up tensions in the world of epidemiology, physiology, and nutrition.
Doctors and researchers argue on Twitter, with some defending and others deriding some of what was in the report.
Now, here are the headlines from that report. Overeating isn't the primary cause of obesity, and studies find primary cause of current obesity epidemic.
Even though most were grateful that a study was done as a long overdue reset of the narrative on weight and metabolism, the model and its central premises prompted great criticism.
Dr. Ludwig, an endocrinologist and researcher at Boston's Children's Hospital and professor of pediatrics and nutrition at Harvard, spoke in the article about what is called the carbohydrate insulin model of obesity. Now, in this model, insulin is thought to play the major role in a chain of events that starts with high glycemic carbohydrates and ends with conservation of energy, increased hunger, and ultimately more fat storage.
This begins a vicious cycle with increased hunger and decreased energy expenditure. They stated that the cycle can be averted with a low-carb, low-glycemic diet.
So as they said, given the choice between bread and butter, for years researchers have focused on getting rid of the butter. Now they feel that maybe we should be concentrating on lowering the bread. According to Dr. Ludwig, all these years we've been working the solution backwards. It's not that people are eating too much, calorie for calorie, and thus gaining weight.
Dr. Ludwig says that the high glycemic carbs we eat sets off a hormonal pathway that causes our bodies to store too much energy, so we are hungrier and eat more.
And Ludwig goes on to say that the current model is not addressing the cause. It's addressing an effect. He explains it like somebody with fever trying to treat the problem by getting into an ice bath.
We have all learned this. Sometimes in our school careers, that energy cannot be created or destroyed. So therefore, if you get in more than you expend, it has to go somewhere.
Ludwig, as well as other researchers, then asked the question, why is that so? Another researcher asked, why does the whole world think obesity is about energy balance? He says it's calories in, calories out. Therefore, it's about two different behaviors, gluttony and sloth. Therefore, if you're fat, it's your fault.
Therefore, diet and exercise, and therefore any calorie, can be part of a balanced diet.
Problem is that this stigmatizes overweight people and negatively impacts almost every aspect of their lives.
People can be considered obese while being free of metabolic issues, just as others can and do have metabolic problems at a normal weight.
The common recommendation, eat less, be more physically active, that we tell people just doesn't seem to actually work. Physicians and nutritionists are often not able to get people to actually reduce their energy intake adequately in order to get them to lose weight.
Many say their perspective pushes the conversation forward. Dr. Jorge Moreno said that he thinks that, as we know, obesity is a huge problem and that we obviously have not been very good at fixing it because of how prevalent it is.
He said while low carb for weight loss isn't new, linking the low glycemic diets directly to weight loss is compelling. We can't use the old model as our driver for change. Now here's where we get into the real nitty-gritty.
Down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Now one, two, nitty-gritty now, yeah.
The authors concluded that based on their model, a low-carb diet would decrease the insulin-to-glucagon ratio, enhance breakdown of fat, and resulting in lower spontaneous food intake.
The authors propose that a high glycemic, high carbohydrate diet leads to a spike in post-meal insulin, a higher insulin to glucagon ratio, which, along with a host of other factors, including genetic, hormonal, microbiotic, and fatty acid type consumed, leads to greater insulin sensitivity in body fat and then increased fat storage.
After this, the energy sources that the body uses, like glucose, ketones, and fatty acids, are depleted, which causes the body to want to conserve energy and unfortunately eat more, bringing an obesity and metabolic problems.
And then to understand all of this, we have to get back to the role of insulin in the body. At least in this current research, insulin is considered the key driver of food intake, leading us to store more fat, which in turn lowers our energy expenditure. And then what happens? It makes us hungrier.
That makes us eat more and get fatter. Studies show that insulin is the key factor that influences energy expenditure, but it is driven by leptin, which we talked about extensively on a previous radio show.
Now here's some more of that nitty-gritty information. Replacing the high saturated fatty foods and refined processed foods that have both types of fat with nuts and seeds and olive oil improves not only the weight, but also the cardiometabolic data. So these things all go together, and they don't have to be mutually exclusive.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Dr. Lasky has been the director and physician at the care center for over 34 years. They are located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection, between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office. They will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Dr. Lasky and Carmen are proud to welcome Dr. Pollan, a board-certified pain management physician, to the practice. The office emphasizes the treatment of chronic pain. They also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any question about Southside Medical Center, please call their office at 641-4411. That's Southside Medical Center, where your health is their primary care.
Now let's revisit some new information on COVID-19. The CDC has begun to provide weekly data on COVID-19 cases and deaths by vaccination status, comparing the major differences between those who have received the shot and those who haven't, and even revealing some differences between vaccines.
Deaths among the unvaccinated peaked the week starting August 8th at about 13 per 100,000 population, while deaths among those who had been vaccinated with one of the three products remained under 4 per 100,000 that week. Now think of those numbers. Unvaccinated, 13 per 100,000. Vaccinated, 4 per 100,000. For the vaccinated, deaths were numerically highest among the Johnson & Johnson recipients at about 3.14 per 100,000, followed by Pfizer at 1.43 and Moderna at 0.73.
Cases were similarly highest among the unvaccinated, peaking at about 736 per 100,000 for the week starting August 15.
Again, there were numeric differences between vaccine groups, with Johnson & Johnson being the highest, 172, followed by Pfizer at 135, and Moderna, 86.
Despite those differences, the overall message is clear. The unvaccinated were at far higher risk of being infected with and dying from COVID-19.
These facts were made public by the CDC, and these should encourage vaccination by more people. The real question is, will these facts that show vaccination being so much better for those vaccinated have a major impact? And the answer seems to be probably no. Paul Offit, MD, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, said that at this point, he does not know how much more information people need that the vaccine is a way to keep you from being hospitalized or dying. He said that he isn't even sure how many in this country actually know who or what the CDC is and what it does, especially concerning COVID-19. Have you ever noticed how vultures seem to congregate around certain areas? I'm not talking about human, I'm talking about birds. And they're congregating around specifically suburb streets and roads. Well, now a study has been done to first of all prove that this is true, and then to try and find out the reason for this.
And this is an especially good time for this article, as vultures are often seen in horror movies, on TV, which are more prominently shown just before and during Halloween.
A GPS analysis of their movements was recently published in Scientific Reports. The U.S. black vulture and turkey vulture populations have surged in the past half century or so, even while many of the other bird species have declined dramatically with encroaching suburban sprawl. Now, did you know that vultures, as unattractive as they might be, are very important as part of our ecosystems? Now, we can think of them as the supreme recyclers, as they eat dead things and thus recycle the nutrients, and they tamp down disease. So, suburban sprawl may be serving up a smorgasbord to them. It appears that these animals adapt better to human-made landscapes, at least better than other birds. So how do you prove this?
Well, a team of researchers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture examined almost 8,000 nights of GPS satellite for 11 black vultures and 7 turkey vultures along the coast of South Carolina.
These birds roosted in their streets, but tended to reject busy city byways or dusty back roads, and instead preferred the middle road.
Oh, you tack the high road, and I'll tack the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore ye, and me and my true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond.
So the vultures like the streets that typically run through suburban areas, surrounded by a mix of natural landscapes and human-made structures.
Although the study wasn't designed to determine why vultures might prefer roadside resting spots, scientists suspect that these locations give them a boost when these large birds need to get moving fast. The warmer surface of asphalt and concrete may actually create thermal currents that lift them.
Easy access to food may be another roadside attraction for vultures, as roadkill makes for a good meal.
You know that when most people think of chronic or long-term pain, they often associate this with previous injuries, like motor vehicle accidents, which left the victims with constant and unending pain even after the main damage has been repaired. But osteoarthritis is the leading cause of long-term pain and disability worldwide. There's no cure for it yet, so the only answer is to help alleviate or at least lessen the chronic pain that these patients suffer with.
The patient's joints become inflamed and they feel creaky and stiff in the morning. Some people use painkillers and exercise as treatment. Others have to resort to surgery and prosthesis.
About 300 million people worldwide currently suffer from osteoarthritis. And a huge study was just completed where labeled samples from more than 800,000 people were examined. And the vast majority of these were from Europe, but a good number from Asia as well.
Just under 200,000 of those surveyed had osteoarthritis. That's 25% or one quarter of the people examined.
The researchers discovered which genes are involved in people with osteoarthritis. Now, this is extremely important because this can in turn be used to develop medicines that can slow down the disease at an early stage. And if you remember from last week's discussion on CRISPR, which could be in the future and have a major effect on many of these chronic problems, most of which are inherited traits carried by those genes.
The researchers also found special risk factors that exist for women and for weight-bearing joints like our knees.
Some medicines targeting the relevant genes are already in use, but they're in use for other diseases. Now, this means that the path to medicines that can slow down osteoarthritis is shorter than it would have been otherwise. The genes in question are essential for the development of bone and cartilage tissue. So they found links between pain and osteoarthritis, and listen to this, links between diabetes and osteoarthritis.
Now, for the first time, they have also identified genes that show a correlation with osteoarthritis and pain.
We would like you, our listeners, to know that Dr. Lasky is one of only a few physicians in the Jacksonville area that has been certified to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call their office at 641-4411. They have also set up a special website at www.compassionatecarejax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of another Hey Doc show.